This episode is brought to you by Element, spelled L-M-N-T. What is Element? Let me tell you, it's a delicious, sugar-free, electrolyte drink mix. As a coach, we are constantly trying to find the best products for our athletes to train and compete at their highest level. Element is a great alternative to other commercial recovery and performance drinks and has enough sodium, potassium, and magnesium to get you feeling and performing your best. Plus, it has zero sugar, no artificial ingredients, and is gluten-free. With a variety of delicious flavors, you are guaranteed to find one your taste buds will love. I know our athletes love the citrus salt, while my favorite is grapefruit. We keep a variety box in the office, and our athletes stop by every day on their way to practice or games to load up. At this point, they won't even touch another product, and I am replenishing our supply on a weekly basis. Without amazing products and sponsors like Element, our podcast would not be possible. Right now, when you click on our affiliate link and place your first order, Element is giving us a 150% commission. That means if you spend $100, we get $150 to keep this podcast running. The best deal you can get is to buy an insider bundle. You buy three boxes, you get one free. And if you click our affiliate link, drinkelement.com/JustinClimo, we will get a commission and you will get a free sample pack with every purchase. Last thing, Element might have the best return policy on the planet. If you don't love it, you will be instantly refunded. Let's talk about sleep for a minute. I've had a terrible time getting productive rest and sleep for the last few years. And since poor sleep can lead to all sorts of health problems, I'm constantly on the hunt for a better night's sleep. Recently, I came across a new product called Beam Dream, which has delivered the best sleep I've had in a long time. The first time I tried it, I fell asleep on the couch within a half hour and didn't wake up until the next day. Since starting my new routine with Beam, my sleep performance has improved significantly according to both my Oura Ring and Whoop Band. Yes, I use both at once because why not have more data? If you are interested in upgrading your sleep, I invite you to try Beam Dream. Today, my listeners get a special discount on Beam's Dream Powder, their best-selling healthy hot cocoa for sleep with no added sugar. Now available in delicious seasonal flavors like cinnamon cacao, sea salt caramel, and white chocolate peppermint. Better sleep has never tasted better. A recent clinical study revealed that 93% of users wake up feeling more refreshed, and 93% reported that Dream helped them get a more restful night's sleep. If you're looking for a way to get some rest and you have trouble sleeping, I highly recommend this product. If you want to try Beam's best-selling Dream Powder, take advantage of their biggest sale of the year and get up to 50% off for a limited time. When you go to shopbeam.com/contacts, discount auto applied at checkout, no code is necessary. That's shopbeam.com/contacts for up to 50% off. If you're a longtime listener, you might know that I've been drinking AG1 for a couple of years. If you're not a longtime listener, then know that I drink AG1 on a daily basis. When I first started drinking it daily, I could feel a real difference in my daily health. I had more energy, I felt more relaxed, I could focus better. That's because AG1 is a foundational nutritional supplement that supports your body's universal needs, like gut optimization, stress management, and immune support. Since 2010, AG1 has led the future of foundational nutrition, continuously refining their formula to create a smarter and better way to elevate your baseline health. I recommend AG1 to all of my family and friends because it has worked so well for me. So much so that my two eldest children have become regular users of the product. My daughter, who has been studying abroad, recently asked us to bring her more product when we went to visit her at Thanksgiving. My other daughter, who's a freshman in college, regularly contacts us to make sure we send her more product. AG1 has been transformational as it has replaced all of the needless ramekins of vitamins and minerals that I used to take. If you really want to take ownership of your health, it starts with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/contacts That's drinkag1.com/contacts to order your own supply and start on your journey to better health. Welcome to the Contacts Coaching Podcast, dedicated to bringing you practical ideas from coaches, sharing what they have learned throughout their career. The show is designed to serve as a digital database of mentorship from a wide network of coaches whose innovative, reflective, and diverse knowledge may offer ideas to enhance your experience. In addition to sport-specific expertise, each episode also dives into the ways in which culture, strategy, and tactics can cross from one discipline to another. I'm your host, Justin Klein. Welcome back to the Contacts Coaching Podcast. We're joined today by Mark Hutch Hunter, calling in from Utah, executive director of the UI AAA for the last 25 years, and author of two books, his most recent one, Hoodoo, which I'm sure he will share about as we get on the show. Coach, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being on. I've done a few podcasts with the UI AAA Connection, but this is only the second time I've been a guest, so it's a little bit different, so I'm excited.
Love it. I want to dive right in. So we met at the National Athletic Directors Conference, your 36th, I'm sure, and my first one. Yeah. Time I've been able to go since it's in the middle of basketball season, and I wanted to touch base and try to pick your brain on the last 35 years of you being in, 40 probably, and being in sports. This is telling me when you retired from actually being in schools and you're still doing this 10 years later. But anyway, let's ground the audience here in how you got into coaching to start, then athletic administration, right? What was the process for that? And then ultimately the situation that you're in now.
All right. Let me start with coaching. You may find this interesting. I was straight out of high school. So this is 1971. Played 3 years of football in high school, played a little bit of basketball and baseball, but not at the varsity level because I wasn't as good. So I'm coaching what they call the Ute Conference here in Salt Lake County, obviously at the University of Utah. I'm an assistant coach with a fellow named Frank Hatch, not Hutch, but Hatch. And he runs the single wing, which no one would know what it is. You would know what it is. And people now know it as the Wildcat. And he was very successful. And so that's my first foray into coaching. Shortly after that, went to a year at the University of Utah, then served a mission for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for 2 years in Ontario, Canada. Loved being there. It was a great place to serve. Came home, went to the University of Utah, and was in business, if you can believe this, and ended up getting married in 75 and lost our first child in August of 76. And it made me, it was a pretty dark time, it was pretty tough, but it made me reevaluate what I wanted to do. I was close to a senior in business. I mean, I'm going to be in business, I'm going to make a lot of money, I'm going to be okay. And I said, yeah, no, I don't want to do that. I want to coach. I want to teach high school kids. So I changed my major, spent another 3 years getting a major in physical education, professional development, and graduated in 79, June of 79. So I took my first job, turns out to be my only job, at Jordan High School in the fall of 79, assistant coach in football, head coach in girls basketball, and assistant coach in track. And then along the way, I also coached. I was the head soccer coach for 1 year back in 83, the first year that came along, and was the baseball coach for 1 year and was offered the position of AD back in 83 if I gave up the baseball job. And I was an average baseball coach. I wasn't great, but I was average, but I was a pretty good football coach. So I took that. So then I became the AD. And back in those days, when I first got the job, it was a 7-period day. I had 1 period for a conference, 1 period to be AD and taught 5 classes. And of course, back in 83, when I first took the job as AD, it's not the same job as it is now. It's not the same job as it was when I left 10 years ago. But that's the short version about how I went into coaching, into executive director. And then, of course, as I mentioned to you earlier, I actually had my son-in-law was at Jordan High before he moved to Corner Canyon as a football coach. He won a championship 2012. I didn't, when I was the AD, I didn't help him coach at all. But since he's been over at Corner, I've been there on game days, and then lately coached some of my grandsons at the freshman and the sophomore level. And as I mentioned to you, I was assistant head coach of the Utah Falcons, semi-professional women's football team. I think the years would be 15, 16, 17, and 18. Won two national championships, and that was fascinating because I heard from zero parents when I was dealing with those women, and they wanted to learn, and some of them were very skilled. And I think our record, I want to say not to brag, but this is bragging a little. I think our record was 39-2 over 4 years. So we were fairly successful. But we ran the Air Force double wing, not the single, but the Air Force double wing. The head coach is a graduate of the Air Force and love, and we ran that option, and our women were not as big as the other women, but they were faster, and our line women were more skilled at their position. And you, when you have to prepare for that triple option, as you well know, that's a whole different story from preparing for an air attack or something like that. Anyway, I became the executive director of the UIAAA. I was the president in 1998. I made this suggestion to the board. I said, we really should think about keeping someone in that knows the association. You came back in those days, you came in as the secretary, president-elect, president, past president, and then you're done. So by the time you get it figured out as the past president and you got it all figured out after 4 years, then you're out the door and the next person comes in. So they say, that's a great idea, Hutch. So we want you to be our first executive director. And so here it is, 25 years later, I'll be stepping down June 30th this year. So I don't know if that was too long, but that's it in a nutshell.
No, that's great. And so many follow-up questions, but we're going to start with this one since you just referenced it. Where does Hutch come from?
Okay. And you'll also find this humorous because you mentioned my two novels. This is in both of the novels at the very first when it describes the character. So I'm in second grade. This is the truth. I'm in the second grade. This is back when the Ute Conference had not a team for every age group, but you had juniors, which were eighth grade, ninth grade. You had bantams, which were 7, 6, and 5. And you had midgets, which were 4, 3rd, and second grade. So I go there and the coach says, hey, guys, thanks to be here. 3 teams. Take your stuff home, put tape across your helmet, and write your name on it so I know your name. And I wasn't paying attention back then, just like I don't pay attention now. I could practice the next day, and the only thing on the front of my helmet is Hutch, the company that made it. And the coach says, hey, you, Hutch, come over here. And believe it or not, that has stuck ever since then.
That's so great. Second grade accidental nickname, and that has become the moniker that everyone knows you by. Oh, that's exactly. So good. That's so good. All right, here's my other deal. I want to go back to your initial entree into all things high school. And you listed this off. I was the assistant football coach, head coach of girls basketball, and coaching track and field in your first year. Take us through that in regards to you had a background in athletics. You'd already served a mission, which for those that aren't aware, you can give a kind of 5-second blurb, but you're gone away from your family for 2 years and you're adulting very quickly. You're right. You're married. You're at the crest of this thing where many people getting into this for the first time are fresh out of college. And while you are fresh out of college, you're 8 years graduated from high school at this point. What did you realize right away in all three of those roles that you needed to figure out that, hey, I'm prepared, but you're not really?
I figured out early on that I thought like most new coaches think, I'm straight out of university. I've seen football on TV. I've seen basketball on TV. I get it. I know how it's done. And when you get thrown into that situation, it's an eye opener. You really don't know what you don't know until you get in there. and you think that you know everything and you think you're the smartest person in the room, when the reality is that you're probably the dumbest person in the room. And the crazy thing is, you don't know you're the dumbest person. You act like you've been there and you've done that. And it's 1979 when you think you've been there and done that, and you've been on the job for 2 or 3 months, and you got a young family at home, you're living in an apartment, you're coaching three sports, which is not unusual for a first year, second year person in high school. I would say the big thing is you didn't know where you could get help, and you didn't know to ask for help because you were too, I don't know if self-centered is the right word, but you're too involved in your own life to think, I got this. I know this. I've been hired to do this. I'm going to be okay. And you quickly realize that you're not. So I don't know if that's the best answer, but that was it for me.
No, I think that's a great answer because, again, speculating, 1979 until now, 43 years in, you are at a place where, hey, I don't know how to do this. Let me just go ask for help. Where when we're young, and that could be construed as a sign of weakness. So why would I be vulnerable and put myself out there? And that's the biggest thing that I think as we get older, we realize, excuse me, more experience versus when we're inexperienced, is, oh, I just got to figure this out, put my head down and work harder. Can you talk a little bit about how your work with the UIAAA has informed that concept of vulnerability and asking for help over the years, and how you would then offer to anybody listening, look, here are all these resources that you have, dig in, you're not alone?
I think the best answer to that is, obviously, back in 99, when I got the executive director, there were some states that had executive directors of their AD associations. The first National Executive Directors Summer Summit was in 2002. And there was 11 people that were there, and I knew one of them. And these were power people in the NIAAA. But I can remember taking over, and our state membership was, I want to say, mediocre at best, maybe 60, 70 members. And our NIAAA membership was maybe 15 or 20. And so I was the leader, but I obviously helped make this happen, but you had to surround yourself with the right people, and we had to get people on the right page. So compare those numbers to the record membership in the NIAAA we had in Utah last year, 235 members. And there's only 155 schools. We have a board now that's 10 people on our board, another 22 people on our athletic director executive committee, one representative from each region around the state. Other states call them leagues or conferences, whatever, we call them regions. But I would say to any of the athletic administrators out there or coaches out there that may be listening, the NIAAA is the premier place. It's where you need to go. The leadership training, you mentioned that earlier, we met in 790, which I'm still an instructor of. I just can't stress enough their professional development, because the NIAAA back in 2002 is different from the NIAAA now in 2023. It's evolved. The leadership training started, I remember taking four courses in Las Vegas at the 99 conference. There was only six courses to choose from, and I took four of them. Those were my first four courses. Now, the most recent Orlando conference where you and I met, 58 courses were taught there. For example, I took 502 when part of the 502 was you need to have athletic handbook. One of the new courses that was taught this year is just about handbooks in and of itself. And of course, I don't have time or the memory to go through all 58 courses, but that's how specific some of the courses have gotten, from that 8-hour course back in 97 in Orlando to now 58. 4-hour courses.
I think the other takeaway from that, as you just mentioned, and I'm taking down some numbers, is your association has grown to have more members than you have schools, which I would say isn't the norm, where you have 155 schools in California. We've got some upwards of 1,200. And right, whether we have that many members or not, the fact that you have more members than you do schools is a testament to not only the way in which it's been emphasized as a resource, but also the way in which people are finding value in that they want to keep growing their network. So from there, let me ask this. So when you were early in career, both as a coach and an athletic director, and the association world was not as big as it was, right? Because you said 1999, you became executive director. You were involved before that. What are some other places that you ended up having to figure out how to coach? What are the resources you used? When I started this show, it was designed to be a digital database of mentorship to help point people to resources that they may not be thinking about. What are some that are hidden gems that you would even offer your coaches today?
I think Big Rich Barton said it the best. He's the associate director at the NIAAA. His course, Coaching the Coaches, I think has been split into two courses. And I think, I don't know if it's the buzzword of the day or the year, but I think 20 years ago, no one thought of the athletic director as a coach of the coaches. I think now you hear that more often. I don't know that the description has changed, but the NIAAA has made it easier for you. And I say easier, not that it's, you can just show up and do it, but it's made it easier to build those relationships because you're in a school, not all the coaches get along. How do we coach the coaches when the coaches can't get along? Some of the coaches hate the AD. Some of the coaches love the AD. Some of the coaches think the AD plays favorites, even though they may not, or maybe even though they may. And so the NIAAA gives you that piece of information that helps you better serve your coaches. I had a guest on just yesterday, and one of a brand new AD, and they said, one of the things I want to do is go to my coaches and say, look, well, give me one thing that I can help you with that's going to take something off your plate that'll make your life easier. Because being a head coach in high school, and I'm not telling you anything that you don't know, being a head coach in high school is not a 9-to-5 job. And these days, it's not even a season job. I can't imagine in the position that you're in as the head basketball coach, you've got summer leagues, your kids travel, you have all that stuff, you got summer camps, and it's coaches years ago came to me and said, I have to do this because if I don't do this, my kids that live in my boundary won't stay. They'll go and they'll play somewhere else where they're going to play 90 games in the summer and they'll play another 25 games in the fall. Whether you agree with that or you don't agree with that is not the point. The point is that's the way some people have called it the youth industrial sports complex is today. And so yet you, interscholastic sports is not professional. Interscholastic sports is not university level athletics, but there are little things that are creeping in that are trying to change that. I think that's a shame. But once again, I'll get off my high horse. We'll go to the next question.
Yeah, because I didn't want to get on mine and go down that rabbit hole with you. Because if you've listened to any of these, I talk about the youth sports industrial complex and the impact it's had on education-based athletics. Right. And it's the keeping up with the Joneses that I think steers kids ultimately to specialize rather than to stay generalists, which for the 3% of the world, sure, go chase whatever. But the rest, the other 97%, let's do everything you can. And so that's my pushback. Absolutely. On it. And at the end of the day, we don't need to go down that rabbit hole. But let me bring us back to this question. 40 years in the business, you're still coaching, you're still assisting. Has your approach changed? What have you started doing? What have you stopped doing? And often you will hear people rail about kids are different. Of course, we're 40 years later. But at the end of the day, one of my mentors talks about cling to unchanging principles, but change with the times. So what are some of those that you've been able to hold on to that have served you well? And what are some of the things that, like, you know what, this isn't productive, regardless of the discipline that I'm teaching?
Let me just give you a humorous story. So I take over as the head girls basketball coach. Never coached basketball in my entire life. Played basketball, watched it, thought that I knew the game. And so this is 79. This is basically 6 years after Title IX. So it's the seventh year going in. As I'm leaving my interview to get the job at Jordan High, you're going to teach math, you're assistant football coach. Oh, by the way, you're the head girls basketball coach. I'm thinking, okay, that's great. First day of school, I find out I don't have a schedule. I go to the principal. I said, I don't have a schedule. I said, what kind of history do we have here? He says, well, you need to know you were 0-6. I said, you're telling me we only played 6 games the previous year? He says, no, I don't think you understand me. We're 0-6. We are 0 for 6 years. Jordan High has never won a basketball game in girls basketball since it started. I said, okay, thanks. So then I'm on my own. I have an assistant. And of course, so I've seen Bob Knight on TV. And I'm coaching girls now, not boys, but I'm coaching girls. I tried some of that Bob Knight stuff. I'm telling you, that first year is a nightmare. I think we were 6-12. Had some kids that could play, had some kids that could shoot, had some kids that could rebound. But I compare my coaching style then to, for example, now, this last year, coaching my grandson on the freshman football team. I say I want to think, but I know that I listen more. I listen to the athlete more. Back when I grew up, it was conditioning, running for no reason. I'd go through 2-a-days in high school, and we would have a break halfway through the 2-a-days, and we had this nasty-looking purple, I don't want to call it Kool-Aid because it tasted horrible. It was some salt concoction and 2 salt pills, and your water break was you ran there, put the 2 pills in your mouth, you drank that, and you went back to practice. I just think, yes, you said the kids are different. The kids are different, but they're still kids. Kids want to be coached for the most part. And I think kids generally want to improve unless they've been born with that silver spoon in their mouth, in which case they're going to have problems long past athletics where they have parental helicopter parents, et cetera, et cetera. So I the long answer to your question is I think I definitely listen more and I'm more aware of the athlete's needs. And I think maybe to a fault for me, and I found this out when I was coaching the women's football team, is these weren't high school kids. These were somewhere between 20 and 42, wide range of women, mothers, single parents, never been married, just a wide range, all different type of religions, black, white, oriental, etc. But I think one of the reasons we were successful, besides the fact that I think we were coached well, is that we had that family, that team unity. And to know athletes on that level is harder when you're in high school because they're kids and they have parents. These women that I coached were grown women and had different jobs, some no jobs, stay-at-home moms. And it was just such a hodgepodge of people that I think that's when I got to care more about the athletes that I coached and listen to more to what they have to say and maybe listen to whatever problems they're having in their life that are not athletic related that you don't always get as a high school coach. So I guess that's my answer.
No, that's all good. I think to your point, the shift of what group of people you're serving is obviously number one, right? It's you come in from somewhere else, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, and it's I don't have that group anymore. And so figuring that out, and as I transitioned from the boys team to the girls team this year, it's trying to figure that out. Here's what we've always done. How are we going to adjust? How am I navigating the frustrations? And ultimately, I think the point you're trying to make is how do you listen? How do you figure out who you're serving? How do you help them create some cohesiveness? And ultimately, at the end of the day, you're going to find whatever success your team is prepared for based on talent level and the way in which you're facilitating leadership.
No, exactly. And I think one thing I also should have mentioned was you may have a preconceived notion of what you want to run or what you want to do. For me, I know the last year I coached girls basketball, we ran that Georgetown style where obviously we had 5 starters, but I played 10 kids because I had 10 girls that could play and could dribble and shoot and we could press and we could do all those things. I tried doing that my second year and we just kept getting blown out by 30 points because I'm the coach and I know best, but I didn't know best. You need to adapt to what strengths you have on your team. So I should have thrown that in also.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think part of that is the evaluation process as you go through it and how are you modifying your approach as you look at what you have. And it's something that I'm wrestling with right now where it's, look, I don't know that I'm at a place where I want to change my approach to teaching basketball to win games. And that's always the challenging thing. It's okay, we can junk this up. We can do some things to give us a better chance of winning. And is that ultimately serving the athletes long term in life, right? Where, and I don't know the answer to this. I'm not saying I'm right. It's just I have a tough time doing that and sacrificing teaching of the game in order to win. And so it's this delicate balance where you got to try to thread the needle that I'm wrestling with right now. And I'd love your thoughts on that as you develop young people into adults, because I've always looked at athletics as a vehicle to teach leadership, followership, how to be part of something bigger than yourself. And at the same time, it's like, all right, do you sacrifice the principles of the truth of the game to go win a game? Or do you understand that the outcome is a derivative of process and sometimes you're just not going to win and that's okay?
No, and I would agree with you 100%. And I think that's, we mentioned interscholastic athletics at the first as opposed to professional. And I think that's what sets interscholastic athletics apart. That's what sets that other classroom of the day apart from what you don't get in your math class, your English class, your history class. The things you learn as a team when you lose and you win and you go through practice and you sweat and you try and you make mistakes and you're successful. That's all part of why scholastic athletics is important.
Yeah, no, I think that's the challenge, right? And as long as what I try to do is keep the student at the center of the equation here and figure out how to coach around that. And it's not always easy. And again, I'm 25 right. years in, you're 40 years in, I'm banging my head against the wall, but I feel like I'm asking the right questions, which is, okay, what am I not seeing here versus let's just keep pounding the stone in something that may or may not be functional. So we'll see how that goes. Let me ask that's this follow-up. 40 years in, you've coached six different sports, it sounds like, but you've also, as the AD, been out and observing, right? And I'm often on my soapbox here about cross-disciplinary teaching and coaching. What have you been able to share from, say, football to coaching track, right? Or when you go out and you watch your, I don't know, soccer team and they're struggling, and instead of going, hey, here's a couple videos on coaching soccer, it's more like, hey, why don't you go watch the tennis team and see what you can steal from them? What have you been able to take? What would your advice be? What are some stories you can share about how you've been able to cross those disciplines as a teaching tool?
I think about when I was the AD and coaches that did get along, coaches that didn't get along, an old school basketball coach that doesn't want their kids in football in any way, shape, or form, although they could use the 6'3 kid in the middle. It's 230 pounds that spent some time on the line. Nobody's going to move him out of there. Specifically to your point about skills from one sport to another, your defenders in soccer, A, those kids are going to be a little bit quicker because they've got foot speed. But a defender in soccer is going to be a great safety or a great cornerback. Your midfielders are going to make a great linebacker. Your attack people, depending on what kind of skills and what kind of speed they have, are going to be great wide receivers, possibly some great running backs. The same thing, it's interesting that you ask that because I'll brag on my son-in-law a little bit. His name's Eric Kerr. I mentioned earlier, he's the head football coach at Corner Canyon, been very successful, but he's the assistant track coach. They will probably win their fifth state title in a row in boys this year. And the comment that I hear when I go to the track, and he says, yeah, but he's got all those football kids running for him. And my answer is, so your football kids can't run? Without exaggeration, he has won since the year before COVID, and they probably would have won during COVID. He has won the 4x1, the 4x2, and the 4x4. And four of the 5 years, 4x8, giving credit to the cross-country kids that run that 800. That's 40 points right there in a track meet. And when you're in a state track meet, that's how you're going to win. And the kids play, and it's easy when you're the head football coach. I shouldn't say it's easy. It's easier because he tells those kids, so if you're not running track, then you're going to be running baseball. And if you're not playing basketball, you're going to be running, you're going to wrestle, or you're going to swim, or you're going to lacrosse. Now is big in Utah. It's a fairly new sport. So you're going to do those things. those kids do it because of the success they've had in in football. But it's made them successful in other sports. And because of their success and the skills they learn in other sports, then that's made them better football players. And so I know I saw a graphic back when Urban Meyer was coach at Ohio State, and it was like a 4-year graphic. It had, I don't know, 44 recruits, 10 a year or whatever. 43 of them were multi-sport athletes. One of them was specializing. And I can't agree with you more. This is high school. This is interscholastic athletics. Let the kids play. Let them get the most experience they can from any sport and all sports all they want, because the likelihood is you're not going to be playing D1. And better still, you're never going to be playing in the pros, even though your parents have been telling you that since you were 2 years old. So I think your point about multi-sport and the skills that you can learn in other sport, they naturally fit into skills that would fit with football, baseball, etc.
Yeah, I don't think there's an argument to be made that your football kids shouldn't be playing multiple sports. I think where the pushback comes is the more finesse sports, where people think that it should be specialization, right? Because football, it's the one sport. You can't really practice out of season, right? You play some 7-on-7 right now. That's getting popular, but it's like weight room. There's always been that the spillover from football. And the other sports are the ones that I think are clamping down. But I've seen the same deal. Like, our kids that matriculate to college are all multi-sport athletes. It doesn't matter what sport they're playing. They're doing other things outside of the season. What have you been able to glean as a coach? What have your coaches been able to see as they coach multiple sports? Or even if they just observe, if I'm the basketball coach and I'm going out to watch soccer practice, what have you been able to help shape in your coaching staffs over the years or in your own mind by watching other sports that aren't your primary?
I used to have, when I was the AD at school, so I've been out for 10 years now, but I was the AD for 30 years before that. We would have a Monday meeting with every one of my head coaches, and it was never an official sit down. Sometimes it was just a walk down the hallway. How was your week going? Blah, blah, blah. And sometimes during those meetings, those exact conversations took place about, well, what about this kid? I'm having trouble with this kid. I know he played soccer. And so then I was able to put him with the soccer coach. And then sometimes we were able to talk about those exact things that you mentioned, about the skills and about how that's going to help. The problem that I faced, and I'm sure you face and everybody else faces, is the problem I mentioned earlier. You inherit your staff. The principal hires and fires coaches. Even though I'm the AD, people think I hire and fire the coach, and that's just not the case. And if you can team build, if you can coach your coaches and have them see your vision, which is going to take some time, once again, it's my old saying, I've said this 3 or 4 times, it's a lot easier to get things done and it's a lot easier to collaborate. But if you get an old school basketball coach that doesn't want to hear about how he needs football players, and of course, the first thing I bring up is because he doesn't want him lifting weights. And I says, have you heard of Karl Malone? And of course, their answer is he's a professional, but they don't want their kids lifting weights during the basketball season. And I'm thinking, wow, you are back from the 70s when I first coached, because that's just not the case anymore.
Yeah, it's always interesting. And I think we can go down that rabbit hole on another conversation, but I think there's value to be had both for your athletes and for the adults to expand your vision to what else is out there, right? It's if you're in business and your specialty is in, I don't know, beverages, and you're only looking to that industry to figure out how to be great versus actually, you know what? These people that are in logistics and moving cargo everywhere might have some things to offer you in regards to how you streamline your business. And so that's like my biggest thing is, okay, where else are we looking for guidance other than like the tunnel vision of what we know? And I think that's the thing that I always try to offer. Similarly, going to like the AD conference, I had more conversations that weren't necessarily about being an athletic administrator, just around other things going on in life, because you have a shared interest. And so you're like-minded in regards to where you're putting your energy. And from that, now there's a little trust. And from that, now you can then get other information. So what would you say as you stepped further away from the day-to-day administrative piece, right? You're not at a site anymore.
Right.
What are some realizations that you've had during that time that you think would have served you really well when you were at a site that you can offer others that are there now, myself included?
I find the first thing, and for the first couple of years, and still is the case, obviously you miss the kids. You miss being around the kids, even though you're not their coach, but you get to know them all. You've got to do all their eligibility, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then the second thing is, I want to make sure that I say this right. You realize that even though you'd been in it for 25 or 30 years, like I was when I left, there's still room for improvement. There's still things that you could have done better. There's still things that ADs are doing in their schools now that I wasn't doing, that I should have been doing 10 years ago when I left. And that just makes me happier just because the growth of our state association and we've been able to share ideas, et cetera. But it makes me sad in a way because I'm not telling you, I was pretty well thought of in Utah. I knew a lot of people. I've been the executive director for 25 years. I've been there, and having that title, there are certain areas that I should have been better at. And there are certain areas that I got better at that took me a while to do it. But it's the same as when you were a coach. It's that same progression as becoming a better coach. It takes that to become a better AD. And if you ever think that you've arrived and you're at the top of the hill and you've made it as a coach or an AD, then maybe it's time you step down, because there's always room for improvement and there's always room for learning.
So what are some of those things that you're referencing when you say there's things that are getting done now that I should have done 10 years ago? What are some of the best things you can offer others that are listening that were aha moments for you as you've stepped away?
I think one of them off the top of my head might have been a student's council or a leadership council, maybe a captain's council. And I'd heard about it and people have done it, and it always was something I wanted to do. And I want to say, I don't want to make an excuse, but I make an excuse because I still taught the half the day. I still had to put the fires out. And so that's the biggest thing that sticks out in my mind. I think that's valuable. I think that for the kids to have a voice in your school is valuable. I never got around to doing it. And I've seen some successful leadership student councils, if you will, from some of the ADs I know around the state. So I think that that would be the biggest thing.
Yeah, and I would say that is something that comes up on here regularly, and something to your point that I never got around to. It's something that's front of mind and it needs to get implemented here. But the takeaways from those are ultimately, to your point, you're giving the students a voice that they may not have without the feedback loops that it creates. So those of you that are listening, roll the dice, give it a run. We're going to when we get back to school here. Anything else that you have thought back on? If I ask you this, which is, what's the best thing you do in your program that were you to take another coaching job tomorrow, it would come with you? What would that be?
Coaching or AD?
Yes.
Or both? Yes. Okay. If it was coaching, I was fairly organized. I'm a fairly anal person. But if I was coaching, particularly the head coach, I would be more organized, if that makes any kind of sense. I would be more aware of the student athlete. When I first started coaching, and I regret to admit this, but I was straight out of college. I was smart. You play to win, to quote Herm Edwards from ESPN.
Former podcast guest, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I like that. That's good. Good job. Perfect. But here's here, and I lost my mind. I was in the middle of saying something, but remind me what I was talking about.
You say you're fresh out of college and you play to win.
Yeah, you play to win. But I think in the professional life, and you see this, Russell Wilson's getting benched for the Broncos. He's making some crazy amount, 30 some odd, 38, 40 million. It's a business decision. When you get to the NFL, when you get to the NBA, for lack of a better word, you're a piece of meat to slide on and off the shelf. What have you done for me lately? And what are you not doing for me now? And it's a business. And I don't want Interscholastic Athletics to ever become a business. I want to keep the values that are there. And I think knowing your students better, for those coaches out there, get to know them. Get to know them on a personal level, know their likes, their dislikes. It's going to help you as a coach, and it's going to help them as a kid.
Yeah, I think ultimately the number one theme over the 3 years of doing this is relationships matter. And how are we building those with the students to help use athletics to guide them to growth in life? And so that is a common theme. So those of us that get stuck in the X's and O's and the minutia of things that are sport related rather than relationship related, it's something to reconsider. Tell me a story about a failure you've had or multiple that have served you throughout your journey in regards to growth.
I think the best example of this would be 1988, maybe. I'm the assistant head football coach at Jordan. I'm ready to become a football coach. I'd been the AD for maybe 5 or 6 years, but like I said earlier, being the AD was not the same as it was now. Unfortunately, the head coach gets cancer, and all through that season, I was the acting head coach. We go to the semifinals. We lose in the semis. I have a talk with the principal. Yeah, I'm interested. This is my chance, because I'd always wanted to be a head football coach in football. And the job goes to somebody else. And I'm crushed. And I'm thinking, wow, that's... how could they pick somebody else? I've been in the program. We were successful. We've been region champions 3 years in a row, on and on. And, but that, I don't want to call it a failure, more of a disappointment. That led to me expanding my horizons with the AD. That's when I became more involved with the state AD association. That's when it was actually before I became involved with the NIAAA. And it was actually when I began to write my first novel after that. And so I became a better athletic administrator because of that. And I'll be honest, I was obviously better for more than a few months. But there's a reason things happen. And I look at my life now and I can't imagine how different it would have been and all the things I would not have done had I got that football job. And since then, I've still been able to coach football in and out in different settings. So it's been great for me. But that's the first one that comes to mind. The second one might be when I ran for the at-large in the NIAAA in 1999 in New Orleans. And once again, I still thought enough of myself that I'm a good AD. People know me. But I was new to the NIAAA. The person I'd lost to had run before and lost and run again and lost and run a third time. And I think I was fortunate enough to serve on the board in 2009. And as much as I think I was ready to serve on the board in 1999, there's no comparison. My contributions in 2009 were so much more, and my professional growth was so much more. Disappointments come in your way, but it's how you handle them and how you move on.
I've always said, through my own experience, sometimes our best decisions are made by other people. And ultimately, to your story there, clearly that has served you. And there's a reason for that. And it steered you into something that was not necessarily more your calling, but at that time and age and stage, that's where you were needed. So that's a great story to share with people, so that everybody out there listening knows that there's doors closed, but there's opportunities there if you embrace them, so to speak. Let's wrap with this. And this is something that I'm always curious about. Going to the conference, taking all these classes. I took 5 while I was there this week.
Wow, that's crazy.
3 weeks ago. But it's, what is something that you have recently changed your mind on? And by that, we get, I don't want to say stuck in our ways, but we get a certain way of doing things. And that becomes the day-to-day grind of things. And unless we get a convincing reason to think otherwise in whatever space we're in, be it at home, be it at work, be it at school, we just keep doing the same thing. And I'm always trying to challenge my beliefs. What is something that you've recently changed your mind on in some aspect of your life where it's, yo, I used to be dug in over here and committed, and now I'm over here, and here's why?
I don't know if this is the best example, but this is what came to mind when you just asked that. I don't know that I would do this today with today's athlete, but going back to that story I told you when I first started coaching girls basketball, we were 0 for 6 years. And so the very first game we have, my first game as a coach, I've decided that we got to change things up. So I told my girls, I said, because how you look impresses people. So they had to wear a skirt and a blouse or a dress to school, and they had to wear it to a game. Because I had scouted a game the day previous, and the girls were showing up in cutoffs and holy jeans and blah, blah, blah. And I said, I have no idea how good we're going to be, but this is how we're going to look. We're at Jordan High. We're the women's team. This is how we're going to be. And sure enough, all the girls showed up. They looked nice. They showed up to the game. This one girl, her name was Allison, ended up playing softball for Utah State. She's in the Salt Lake County Hall of Fame. Such a great softball player. She wears her jeans to school. And so now, here's the first big decision as a coach. What are you going to do? Blah, blah, blah. And I tell her that she's not starting. So obviously, when it comes time, you have to show up 30 minutes before game time or the JV game, et cetera, et cetera. She comes, all the girls are dressed how they were in school. She's got this nice dress on. And whether right or wrong, she sat by me in the nice dressed, not suited up, and we won the game. The first game in the history of Jordan High women's basketball, won the game by 1 point at the buzzer. And this isn't just any girl. This is a girl that could put up 25 a night. She could shoot the rock. She was a player, and this is back in 79. Now, whether I would do that today, whether I would still, because I always... It was different when we rode the bus on the way. I let them dress a little bit more casual. But I was convinced back then, this is how you need to look, because I think that sets the tone when your opponents see you. And I think I've softened on that. Of course, I'm a lot older, but I think I've softened on that. So I think that's hopefully the best answer to your question.
Well, I don't – yeah. You got – you only have – so many things you can care about. And ultimately, like I'm sure you've talked about this over the years at the conference, when you put your team guidelines or rules or whatever the right way, it's not a policy because it's not in some sort of real formalized deal. But it's like when you're young and you start off, there's 25 things on there. When you're a little more experienced, there's 2, right? And it's okay. Where are you pushing your chips in regards to the things that you have the energy to hold people accountable to? And at the end of the day, how does that impact what you're trying to teach the kids? So if it's super important for you to get them to dress nicely, okay, maybe that's the hill you die on. And if it's not, right, you want them to come pull in the same direction as a team. Is that the best way to do it? Who knows? I don't know what any of those things. I know I was in the same boat. It was like team shoes, team this, team that. And it's couple of Jones fractures in the feet will teach you real quickly, hey, I'm not going to mandate that people do anything anymore. And so I think the evolution of thought is the key, right? What are the things that you're holding on to that are timeless principles versus the specifics of what those principles are designed to do? And I like that story. I think there's probably plenty more of those that you can go through as you walk around now with that kind of in the back of your mind. All right, let's do this, coach, and then I'll let you get back to Utah. Tell us a little bit about Hoodoo. Tell us about the previous book and the 20-year gap in between them?
More like a 30-year gap. So right after, I mentioned it, right after I don't get the football job. So I was still the AD. I was still coaching girls basketball, but not football. So I began maybe in the 1990, spending an extra hour a day at school, and I would just start writing. And you need to understand, for those out there that are English majors, that's not me. I was a math guy. I was a horrible English student. I had trouble spelling, etc. I had trouble putting my thoughts on paper, but this kid had challenged me. I thought I was going to do it. So it takes me 2 years to write the first book, Plateau. It's about a guy named Pinkerton Todd who spent an extra 10 years in Europe after the First World War, comes back to America, meets with some of his buddies, goes down to the Grand Canyon, meets his old high school buddy, gives him a little bit of a riddle, and unfortunately he dies in a plane crash coming back to Salt Lake. And the rest of the book is just, the hero of the book is just a normal person that gets caught up in this hunt for what turns out to be the fictional Newhouse diamond and diamonds that are with it. And so that was my first attempt. It was just a story that was all up here in my head. I just wrote till I got to the end. It's about 300 pages. Okay. About 18 months ago, I said, man, maybe I have a second book in me. My kids were asking me, you have a second book? And I said, yeah, but I got to have a plot. I got to have it figured out. I got to know where I'm going to go. The first book was just all up here. This hoodoo was different. My son says, well, yeah, you can just have Pinkerton Todd do blah, blah, blah during the Depression. I said, the problem is he got killed in a plane crash. So he has a brother, Jefferson Todd, who's a famous private detective in Utah till the Depression hits in 1929. Who then overnight becomes broke, tries to struggle as a living, making tables as a carpenter, et cetera, et cetera. And he gets caught up in something called the Holmes Legacy, who he's hired to investigate. He gets back into investigation in a little bit. So it's not really a prequel. It's a tie-in with the previous character. But they're both just adventure novels, a mystery. Both take place in Utah. Plateau, obviously referenced to the plateau of the Grand Canyon. Place that I've been to probably 40 times in my life. Hoodoo, reference to the hoodoos of Bryce Canyon, where some of this book takes place. And so if there are any of you out there that like reading mystery adventures, pick them up. You can get them on Amazon. You have to type my name in. It's Mark, M-A-R-C, Hunter. And then just either put Plateau after it or Hoodoo. It'll take you to it. You can get the Kindle version, electronic only. But obviously, I'm proud of him. But like you asked me earlier, how are the sales going? Hoodoo's selling a lot better than Plateau at this point, just because I'm a little bit more social media savvy. Plateau came out during the COVID year. I dusted it off because I sat for so many years, couldn't find anybody to publish it. My niece tells me that she published something on Amazon, so I find out how that works. And I think, well, I'm going to self-publish it. If I only sell a couple hundred copies, I only sell a couple hundred copies, but at least I'm going to be a published author. And that's that. Yeah, it's both of them just mystery adventures, one of them during the Depression time. The first one took place probably in the 1991 era, so it's a little bit dated 30 years ago. But I'm proud of them, and I think they're okay. I've had people say that they like him, waiting for the next one. And the difference with Hoodoo is, so I had to sit down. So I had to research and I had to put down a plot and where I want this to go and where this person goes and this person goes. My wife tells me I had too many characters in my first book, which I probably did, characters that were only in for a paragraph or two paragraphs. But like I say, that first one, I just had an idea in my head. I just did it. This one, I've had to research the price of gold. FDR outlawed gold in the United States in 1934, right when the middle of this book happens. Not to give any of the plot away, but it involves possibly some gold bullion. If you own gold in the United States, you could be arrested because you're a criminal, et cetera, et cetera. And once again, I just wrote about what I knew. Obviously, I'd been to Bryce quite a few times in my life, so I picked those titles just from the places from the national parks because I'm a national park guy. I've been to lots of them. I'm just an outdoor, like doing it. And so there's the plug for my two novels.
My takeaway is this. Like anything, growth and learning matters, right? So you had to sit down and plan it out after the first one. It was just whimsical, right? And so I think the growth, the commitment to craft, the willingness to research, and more importantly, to take a chance on something. You say, I'm a math guy, I'm writing a book. Like, at the end of the day, we can all do whatever it is we want to invest time in. So, hey, get the books, read them up, try some things you may not feel that you're super confident about in your own space, and keep pounding the stone in your growth and opportunity to get better at life. So, Coach, thanks for being here today. Appreciate it. Looking forward to coming out there and exploring Utah.
Thanks for having me. And for your listeners, Justin's going to be on the UIAAA Connection podcast coming up here in 2 or 3 weeks. It might even be a month, but it'll be like my third guest from California. So thanks for having me on. It's been an honor and a privilege, and was glad to meet you at the national conference. And it was great.
This episode is brought to you by Element, spelled L-M-N-T. What is Element? It's a delicious sugar-free electrolyte drink mix. As a coach, we are constantly trying to find the best products for our athletes to train and compete at their highest level. Element is a great alternative to other commercial recovery and performance drinks and has enough sodium, potassium, and magnesium to get you feeling and performing your best. Plus, it has zero sugar, no artificial ingredients, and is gluten-free. With 8 delicious flavors, you're guaranteed to find one your taste buds will love. I know our athletes love the citrus salt. We keep a variety box in the office, and our athletes stop by every day on their way to practice and games to load up. At this point, they won't even touch another electrolyte product. Without amazing products and sponsors like Element, our podcast would not be possible. Right now, when you click on our affiliate link and place your first Element order, Element will give us 100% commission. Last thing, Element might have the best return policy on the planet. If you don't love it, you'll be instantly refunded.